welcome to all of you, and a particular and special word of welcome to the Honourable Chikunga, the Chairperson of the Police Portfolio Committee, as well as any other members of her Police Portfolio Committee who may be present. You're welcome. We thought it only appropriate that they should share this presentation with us today, because although the Justice Portfolio Committee has been tasked with considering this bill, it does affect police directly. So, Advocate DeLange, I hope you feel comfortable with very modern technology. And so I'll ask you to please proceed.
Chair, thank you very much. Let me just say for starters that I'm pleased to be back with something real in the committee after quite a long absence. Chair, with your leave, I will just kick off directly with this presentation, which of course deals with Section 49 of the Criminal Procedure Act, the section that regulates the force that is allowed to be used during an arrest. So I've given a presentation, I've distributed the presentation to the members of the committee, and you will note that during the course of the presentation I will be referring to my privileged speaker's notes that give me the edge to know more about the topic, but it is electronically with Mr. Romano, and I think members might benefit if it's emailed to them electronically as well, so that they can have the benefit of reading the speaker's notes as well. There's lots of cross references and references to relevant material there. See, this bill follows a request that was made to the department by the Minister of Police. We prepared the bill, proposing an amendment to Section 49 of the Criminal Procedure Act in order to bring it into line with the judgment of the Constitutional Court in the case of ex parte Minister of Safety and Security and Others versus Walters. You will hear a lot about that case during the course of deliberations on the bill. We've subsequently invited public comment on our draft at the time. We did receive quite a lot of comment, evaluated it, and made certain refinements to the bill that was subsequently introduced. Now, the bill strives to enhance effective law enforcement by providing greater legal certainty to arresters as to the circumstances under which force may be applied when they attempt to effect an arrest. And I want to pause from the outset. I want to mention to you, at no stage was the Department of Justice asked to look at preparing legislation that goes beyond Walters. What the Constitutional Court said in Walters is the law. And this legislation does not and it cannot seek to amend the legal position as set out by the Constitutional Court in Walters. I want to make that very clear up front, regardless of any other thing that was said or speculated or reported. It cannot go unless we attempt to amend the Constitution. We cannot tamper with the framework of the law as set down by the Constitutional Court. Then, Chair, the following slide. I think it's important when you deal with this subject to just look at Section 49 in the context of the Criminal Procedure Act. I think most members here who's acquainted with the Act will know that it's a fairly logical Act, starting with Chapter 1, 2, 3, etc. Each chapter denoting a process to be followed in the courts of law, criminal law, and it starts off by the authority to prosecute, then the methods of obtaining an accused presence in the court, etc., pleadings, etc. Now, it's hardly necessary for me to mention that there are various ways of obtaining the presence of an accused in court. It can be a summons, there can be a notice, a written notice to appear in court, and in the rather more serious cases, you get the arrest procedure. And I think it's important just to look at where Section 49 fits in the context of the Criminal Procedure Act. Now, Section 5 of the Criminal Procedure Act deals with arrest. It's Sections 39 to 53. 39 says the manner and effect of arrest, that's where that is governed. Section 40, arrest by peace officer without a warrant. 41, the name and address of persons. 42, arrest by private persons without a warrant. I've put a little asterisk there because I just want to pause later on that section. 43, the issuing of warrants by magistrates and judges, the execution of warrants in 44, 45, arrest and telegraphic authority. Fortunately, I don't think we're not called to dwell too much on that, but I think there is room to argue that that is rather an archaic provision. 46, non-liability for wrongful arrest. 47, private persons to assist in arrest when called upon. 48, breaking open premises for purposes of arrest. 49, the use of force when effecting arrest. And 50 to 53, procedures after arrest, offence and escaping savings. And I want to refer members to a quote from paragraph 33 in the Valkers judgment here already, just to put the thing in context, where Judge Crisler said, and members will recall that it was a unanimous judgment of the Constitutional Court, where he said that it should also be noted that we are not concerned here with the weighing up of competing rights to bodily integrity, dignity and life in the context of self-defense or the protection of the life or safety of someone else. The principles of private defense are not an issue in this case. Section 49 is not directed at the right to defend oneself or someone else against the threat of harm. That right is not challenged in this case, nor is it addressed in this judgment. This needs to be emphasized, as in some of the material submitted on behalf of the SAPS seems to suggest that the right of police officers to defend themselves and others against threats of violence would be put in jeopardy by interpreting Section 49 along the lines suggested by counsel for the Minister of Justice and the Amicus Curiae. I'm just writing this to sort of focus on that we're dealing with arrest, nothing beyond arrest. Then turning to Section 39, it's the first section dealing with this, 39, manner and effect of arrest. 39.1 says an arrest shall be effected with or without a warrant, and unless the person to be arrested submits to custody, by actually touching his body or, if the circumstances so require, by forcibly confining his body. Now, members will see that, unfortunately, I don't think you've got the benefit of the screen. I've put the unless there in red. Just to make the point that arrest does not always, in fact, should not always be accompanied by any form of violence. What the Criminal Procedure Act says, you can inform a person that you arrest the person. And if the person do not submit to custody, then you can go ahead and touch the person. And if the circumstances so require, you can forcibly confine that person's body. The person effecting the arrest must, at the time of effecting the arrest or immediately thereafter, inform the arrested person of the cause of the arrest, or in the case of an arrest effected by virtue of a warrant, upon demand of the person arrested, hand him a copy of the warrant, and then what the effect of the arrest is, basically that you are in detention. If members care to look at the speaker's notes that will be distributed, Deemstra also draws attention to the fact, Deemstra criminal law, which I think is still regarded in academic circles as one of the authorities when you study law, on the importance of just taking note of the fact that the arrest is not the only way that you obtain an accused's presence to a court, that the only purpose of arrest in all cases must always be to ensure the presence of a person to court. You're not allowed to arrest a person to intimidate him or to punish him, etc. And we'll get to that a bit later on, but I just want to register fact. Section 42, draws very briefly there, Chair, because of course Section 49 is not only applicable to the police, private persons can also affect arrests. 42 says any private person may without warrant arrest any person who commits or attempts to commit in his presence, or whom he reasonably suspects of having committed an offence referred to in Schedule 1. B, whom he reasonably believes to have committed any offence and to be escaping from and to be freshly pursued by a person whom such private person reasonably believes to have authority to arrest the person. And C, for whom he is by any law authorised to arrest without warrant in respect of any offence specified in that law. And D, whom he sees engaged and afraid. stipulates that if you're authorized to arrest without a warrant, you may pursue the person, any other private person may join you. Three, the owner, lawful occupier, or person in charge of property, in respect of which any person is found committing an offence, and any person authorised thereto by the owner, occupier, or person in charge may, without warrant, arrest the person so found. I'm not going to dwell too much upon this. I think it is important to take notice of this provision, as I said, because private persons can also affect arrests, and then obviously they will also be subject to the provisions of Section 49 as soon as they start using violence to affect those arrests. But I want to refer to Martinez 1990. It's a case State versus Martinez, where the appellate division said, the old appellate division that is, a warning that was given in that case, which merits quoting, according to Hemstra, and I want to quote, that the power conferred on a private citizen to arrest without a warrant should be exercised sparingly and with great circumspection. The use of a firearm in an attempt to effect such arrest should be resorted to with even greater caution. I think just to register that in my experience, I do not know of really private citizens' arrests. It's not something that's common, but it is necessary to just govern that aspect as well. Then an interesting provision, which also, I must say, the authority that I found in this section, they are all rather old, the latest one, 1928. But it's the duty on male inhabitants, very discriminatory, which is arguable. It says that every male inhabitant of the Republic of an age not below 16 and not exceeding 60 years shall, when called upon by any official police official to do so, assist such a police official in arresting any person or in detaining any person so arrested. I think it is important that the legislature, in its wisdom, then gave the police that discretion to determine the age of a person so accurately. Any person in subsection 2 who is a fish with, I did it in a previous presentation, Chair, but I will not in this instance point out the people who is exempt from this provision.
But interesting, I mean, I would think it's gender discrimination makes it clearly unconstitutional. I've also got problems with forcing a child to participate in an arrest, in terms of the way we've been developing the
age law. Not below 16.
Not below, but a child is 18.
Mm. All right, so we'll look at that.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's not before us, and presumably we can't, but I wouldn't mind amending it.
Chair, if I may, just to amuse you further, the existing authority on this section is rather interesting. For example, a cripple will be excused if he refuses to help. That was in Rex Mugwenya 1925 decision.
That's a relief.
If someone can show that he in good faith believed that the person requesting his help was not a police official, he will be excused because mens rea is an element of the offence. That is Rex versus Lakeyear, a 1934 decision. If a police official in civilian clothing identifies him or herself as such, the person whose assistance was requested will have to show that there was a reason to disbelieve the police official. That was Rex versus Ballendorf in 1920. And the state also has to prove for a conviction in terms of subsection 2 that the arrest or attempted arrest was lawful. That was Rosenthal in 1927. I think we can move on to the next section, Chair. This is more the business end of what we're dealing with now. Now, I think it's common cause 49 ended up in the Constitutional Court in the Walters case. Now, what served before the Walters case was section 49 before it was replaced by Act 122 of 1998. 49 at the time read as follows: if any person authorized under the Act to arrest or assist in arresting another attempts to arrest such person, and such person firstly resists the attempts and cannot be arrested without the use of force, or B, flees when it's clear that an attempt to arrest him is being made or resist the attempt and flees, The person so authorized may, in order to effect the arrest, use such force as may in the circumstances be reasonably necessary to overcome the resistance or to prevent the person concerned from fleeing. And then in red text, the problem, so-called justifiable homicide clause, which used to say that where the person concerned is to be arrested for an offence with 13 Schedule 1 or is to be arrested on the ground that he or she is reasonably suspected of having committed such an offence, and the arrester, if I can use the abbreviation, cannot arrest him or prevent him from fleeing by other means than by killing him, the killing shall be deemed to be justifiable homicide. I don't think we need to dwell upon that. It is clear as daylight that this is a problematic provision. And in fact, to their credit, the first parliament post-94 recognized it from the start. And there are a few members here that I recognize that who were part of the wrestling we had in 1998 when 49 was revisited. Now, about
Importantly, in I,
He said these limitations in no way detract from the rights of an arrestor attempting to carry out an arrest to kill a suspect in self-defense or in defense of any other person, which really connects to what we said earlier, that 49 is concerned with arrest. It's not concerned with self-defense. It's where there's an overlap, where you have to act in self-defense by executing your duties to arrest, the legality of your actions will be governed by the common law relating to self-defense, not by 49. I also want to very briefly pause on what the Constitutional Court said, where it said that arresting a suspect, paragraph 49, that is. And Jim, forgive me if I repeat or if it is repetitive, but I think it is rather important. Arresting a suspect in terms of sections 39 and 49 is one of these police duties. The purpose of an arrest is to take the suspect into custody and be brought before court as soon as possible on a criminal charge. It does not necessarily involve the use of force. On the contrary, the use of any degree of force to effect an arrest is allowed only when force is necessary to overcome resistance by the suspect or anyone else to an arrest by the person authorized by law to carry out such arrest. Arrest is not an objective in itself. It is merely an optional means of bringing a suspected criminal before court. Therefore, resistance or flight does not have to be overcome or prevented at all costs. Thus, a suspect whose identity and whereabouts are known, or who can otherwise be picked up later, can properly be left until then. Even when the suspect is likely to get clean away, if not stopped there and then, arrest at every cost is not warranted. The might of the law need not be engaged to bring to book a petty criminal. And Chair, just in the course of an ordinary business day on legal briefs the other day, my attention was drawn to a judgment in Erasmus, Eastern Cape judgment, where traffic police officials had a roadblock and arrested a 42-year-old woman for not having a driver's license on her. Detained her in a taxi, detained her in the police cells, with the whole crowd of students, etc., joking, and the bottom line is 75,000 rand damages. Now these things happen, and I think that is just an illustration of how important it is to note what the purpose of an arrest is, when do you arrest, and not to threaten people with arrest. That is another big problem that we see. Yeah, but merely to threaten people that they will be arrested for this or that can in itself be a very negative message that you send to the people on the ground who take the instructions from very high up and who look up to that. But I'm sure that when during the deliberations, there's other cases could see it. There's a host of cases where damages are being awarded to people for having been unlawfully arrested, unnecessarily arrested. So I think that when we're dealing with arrest in context, it's such a sensitive issue. There's such a lot of training involved and knowledge to be applied when you start putting these provisions in motion on the ground, and it's not an easy task. We very, very quick to recognize that, but it's a very important task that whoever performs these duties really know the law, the legal framework in which they have to operate. Now, the existing section 49, as it is at the moment, as it was changed in 1998, the heading is still the same, use of force in effecting arrest. In arrest, and then there's a new 49.1 that we introduced at the time, which is just a small definitions clause. We tried to steer away, members will recall the old 49 that we just discussed. There was this repetitive references to any person authorized by this act to arrest, blah, blah, blah. We tried to make it easier by putting in a definition for arrestor and a definition for suspect, so that you can, when it comes to the real operative provision, not need to repeat these expressions. I'm not even going to dwell upon that. I think it's very clear what it says. 49.2 is the big issue as it stands at the moment. It says that if any arrestor attempts to arrest a suspect and the suspect resists the attempts or flees, or resist the attempt and flees, when it is clear that an attempt to arrest him or her has been made and the suspect cannot be arrested without the use of force, the arrestor may, in order to effect the arrest, use such force as may be reasonably necessary and proportional in the circumstances to overcome the resistance or to prevent the suspect from fleeing. That part of the text is in black. It is really the proportionality test, and it is really everything that is set in the Walters judgment when those criteria were set down, save for the part when you actually start using deadly force or shooting at a person. And this is why I put this in red text, because this is where the problem arises. It then goes on to say that provided that the arrestor is justified in terms of this section in using deadly force that is intended or is likely to cause death or grievous bodily harm to a suspect, only if he or she believes on reasonable grounds, firstly, that the force is immediately necessary for the purposes of protecting the arrestor, any person lawfully assisting the arrestor, or any other person from imminent or future death or grievous bodily harm. B, that there is a substantial risk that the suspect will cause imminent or future death or grievous bodily harm if the arrest is delayed, or C, that the offence for which the arrest is sought is in progress and is of a forcible and serious nature and involves the use of life-threatening violence or strong likelihood that it will cause grievous bodily harm. Now, the problem statement regarding Section 49 as it is at the moment, and many of the commentators who were interested in this section and addressed me informally kept asking me, but why? Why tamper with it? The situation you dealt with in front of Walt, why are you and what are you seeking to achieve? So I just need to briefly reflect on this. Firstly, we've just read Walters. We've heard how the law was expressed. And I think it's very clear that there's a big difference in the terminology used in the way that it was set out in Walters and in what we've just read, what the existing wording is with regard to the proviso. Now, obviously, this existing one was formulated in 1998. Walters came, I think, in 2001. And we're now in 2011. So, obviously, the legislature at the time was playing a guessing game. Only to their credit, like I said, they recognized from the start that there's a problem with the old 49, but they did their best, and this is the wording that they came up with. Then secondly, it is being criticized, and this is academic, but I think members will realize as we proceed with this, this is to a large extent an academic exercise as well. The existing provision was criticized as being difficult to interpret, and as equating the use of force for arrest to the law of self-defense, leading to uncertainty among police officers regarding legitimate use of deadly force. And it is viewed by some academics, again, as narrower in application than the guidelines furnished by the Constitutional Court in the Walters case, since the court made it clear that shooting to prevent a suspect from fleeing would be sanctioned if the suspect is reasonably suspected of having committed a violence offense involving the infliction of seriously bodily harm. So again, I want to pause very briefly. I've translated a paragraph from an article written by Netling and Potgieter in the THRHR of 2003, just to illustrate the point, where they at the time argued, and must now remember, this was after Walters, but before the existing section was put into force, where they argued that the question arises whether, in view of Govender and Walters, it would at all be sensible and appropriate to put this section into operation. In our opinion, this would not be desirable. Firstly, the interpretation of the old Section 49(1) by the SEA and the Constitutional Court now complies with the demands made by the Constitutional Bill of Rights, whilst it is still uncertain whether or not the pending Section 49 would comply with those in all respects. Secondly, the interpretation of 49(1) is now so clear that legal certainty is achieved, whilst the new Section 49 is unnecessarily clumsy and vague in some respects. And then there's a cross-reference to another article. Thirdly, the pending section ostensibly contains a lacuna compared with the existing 49, since it only allows the application of serious or deadly force against a suspect in situations of self-defense, and thus does not provide justification for such force where the suspect was involved in a violent offense that resulted in serious bodily harm. Fourthly, if the new 49 is removed from the statute book, the controversy that raged since the passing thereof, especially between the Departments of Justice and Safety and Security, would be settled. Furthermore, the fear that the new new section would not afford adequate protection to the police in potentially violent situations is satisfactorily addressed by the three judgments in question. Now, I want to zoom in on the specific request that the department received from the South African police via the then minister, or in fact still the Minister of Police. The argument was that the effect of 49 as it stands at the moment is that the police officer may not shoot at a suspected murderer or rapist unless the police officer believes on reasonable grounds that the suspect is a serial murderer or a serial rapist. Or
sorry, unless can we ask Mr. De Lange to make use of all the technology available to him?
My apologies. This is actually, and I appreciate also that this has been drawn to my attention because I designed this to overwhelm the members who are in of the brilliant.
That's how overwhelmed we are. You
the first bullet they are worried. The second one, the armed murderer or an armed murderer or rapist who is fleeing without threatening anyone must be pursued by the police officer in order to catch up with and arrest the suspect, all the while running the risk of the suspect suddenly turning around and firing at the police officer. The limitations imposed by 49 on the use of deadly force when effecting an arrest are more restrictive than the criteria laid down by the Constitutional Court. And lastly, 49 has given a right to flee to all those suspected criminals who are not suspected of being serial killers or rapists. Again, Chair, I want to reiterate. We as a department never really saw eye to eye on the police on their interpretation of 49. And even these arguments we view as arguable. But the bottom line is we're not applying the provision. It is the police. It is they that being trained. It is they that must understand it. And regardless of what extent we lecture them and we argue with them, it is not our responsibility eventually to apply this. They have, I've quoted from Heemstra earlier. From Heemstra already it is clear that there's provisions, there's difficulty and uncertainty. On the intranet of both the Department of Justice and the Department of Police, we've got C.R. Snyman's Law on Criminal Law, his work on criminal law, which is also one of the Bibles of criminal law in South Africa, he's studying law. And I just want to make a brief reference to what Snyman is saying. And again, I'm not saying that we agree with Snyman's exposition. It's very arguable, but the kind of confusion that he raises is as follows. He gives a hypothetical example. On a charge of murder, and I'm quoting from paragraph 11 on page 164 of his work. On the charge of murder, X will not succeed in relying on the defense. Sorry, let me start with a new. I don't want to bore you with the whole paragraph. But he says, why is it right not to be killed? Why the suspect? But to run away and hide until the police manage to apprehend him must, according to the philosophy underlying section 49, be respected. It outweighs X's and his deceased wife's as well as society's rights or interest that murderers be apprehended. He goes on to say the position is the same if X, a security guard, witnesses Y shooting and killing Z and driving off in Z's car in the course of a car hijacking. X may neither kill nor even seriously injure Y in order to prevent Y's escaping. The law affords Y a right to life and to run away. Now again, I'm not saying that we agree with this, but it is there, and it is a bone of contention, and it does place the people in police who are responsible to train them in a very difficult position when your authorities, whether you agree with them or not, create this kind of confusion. So the aim of our amendment really is to erase this kind of uncertainties, to bring Section 49 closely into line with the wording used, the criteria laid down in the Walters case. We insert the definition of deadly force to promote clarity. We'll get to that in a moment. And paragraphs A to C of the proviso being replaced with wording that is almost exactly that word in the Walters case. In the process of developing this legislation, We submitted a bill for comment. We invited public comment on a bill, and the content of the bill that we submitted for comment was as follows. We tampered with 49.1b, very, very superficially. We just took out the "or had." Of course, we think that that is superfluous. It serves no purpose, but that's not important. Then we added the definition of deadly force and said deadly force means force that is intended or likely to cause death or grievous bodily harm. The only reason we did that was so that when you come to the body, subsection 2, it is not necessary to repeat that sentence. You can simply refer to deadly force. So that is just cosmetic. Then we inserted a new 40, or we amended 49.2. Now the blue text on the slide is left unchanged, as we discussed earlier. That is the proportionality requirement, preceding the proviso, and it is really that is really the main, the principle that is being introduced by 49.2. Everything in blue can survive if we omit the whole of the proviso, for example. And in fact, we got comment to that effect from the judges of one of the benches of the High Court that asked us, but why don't we simply not delete the proviso? Because the whole matter, everything is governed in two. Two is your principle. It says any arrester can arrest. If the person resists, you may use such force as is reasonable and proportional in the circumstances. Full stop. But we can get to that just now. So that is what we put out for comment. And in the process, amended the proviso by saying that the arrestor is justified in terms of this section in using deadly force, and we took out the part thereafter because that is part of the definition now. Only if he or she believes on reasonable ground, A, that the force is, we took out the immediately, again because we argued that immediately serves no purpose. If force is necessary, it must be immediately necessary. By stating there that the force must be immediately necessary, you're implying that the force can be necessary later. And so, but in any event, this is not part of the bill as introduced. It's just for interest sake, I'm pointing it out. And in B, we took out that proviso and replaced it with that the suspect is suspected on reasonable grounds of having committed a crime involving the infliction or threatened infliction of serious bodily harm, and there are no other reasonable means of carrying out the arrest, whether at that time or later, and the completely removed C. That's the bill, the draft bill that went out for comment. We then received comments on the bill from 18 interested persons and institutions. I want to mention briefly that none of the organized legal professions submitted any comment. We made a point of approaching them directly, but be that as it may, I'm sure that the committee can look forward to the benefit of having their input.
Yes. They're able to make more money if there's uncertainty.
Well, see, it's always difficult to complain that you've not been consulted.
Yes, we know.
Okay, then a number of commentators emphasized the need for adequate training of the members of the SAPS in the use of force. And I want to predict that you will probably find the same in the comments, that it's unfortunately an emotionally charged issue, and our experience was that the people focused not so much on the legalities around 49, but on wider, broader issues, what's happening daily, etc., which is really not strictly related to 49. But in any event, we took all these comments in consideration. We've in fact made copies of the revised bill, took it into consideration, and then we revised the bill, and let me just discuss those revisions firstly, what we've done as a result of that. After the comments, we've changed the definition of deadly force. The original proposal there was means force that's intended or likely to cause death or serious bodily harm. We revised it to say force that is likely to cause serious bodily harm or death and includes but is not limited to shooting at a person with a firearm. Now, firstly, we took out the intended because, in line with what we've discussed earlier already, you do not the purpose of 49 and the use of force there is to effect an arrest, and you do not arrest a dead person. So you do not intentionally kill a person in order to arrest that person. So the intention, the intended there is really not called for. So and some of the commentators picked this up, and we agreed with that, and we removed the intended there. So it is now likely to proceed as bullying. And then we added includes, but is not limited to shooting at a person with a firearm. Some of the commentators said, but Walters doesn't refer to deadly force. Walters refers to shooting. And the choice then was, do we change it to shooting? But the problem then is, there are many kinds of deadly force. A karate chop to the neck of a frail person can amount to deadly force. Setting a police dog or a dog on a child or on a person can amount to deadly force. So we want to avoid shooting, but we thought that it would be prudent, just to make it absolutely clear, that shooting is also included, but we also thought it's important to say shooting at a person. Not shooting a person, shooting at a person with a firearm. In this way, also making it clear that, and I think that is, for me personally, was one of the problems with the existing 49 deadly force, that can, etc., etc. My problem there was the mere discharge of a firearm would in itself amount to deadly force, even if it's not directed at any person. The force is the discharging of the firearm, which make it difficult for the police to shout at the person, stop or I shoot, or to fire a warning shot. Now, if you specify and saying, but it's not limited to shooting at a person with a firearm, I do think that you leave that scope. You can actually say, let's stop or I shoot, or discharge a shot into the air or into the ground to make the person think twice before continuing with his flight. I'm still with the changes that we've made after the Commons Chair. We've changed the proviso in subsection 2. I've put the changes in red text, provided that the arrester, and we include now, is justified in terms of this section in using deadly force. So we're taking all of that out and insert the words, may use deadly force only. This is very much in line with what we've just read in Baltus. If we take out those words and we say A, we take out the whole of the old A, and we insert, if the suspect offers a threat of serious violence to the arrester or another person. That was exactly the wording used by Krichler in Walters, and in fact, I think he uses two versions. I used suspect offers a threat, but in that passage that I quoted earlier where he set up the legal position, he said the suspect poses a threat. The bill as introduced now says poses a threat. Then secondly, the second paragraph, the proviso, the arrester suspects on reasonable grounds that the suspect has committed a crime involving the infliction or threatened infliction of serious bodily harm, and there are no other reasonable means of carrying out the arrest, whether at the time or later. I want to wrap up, Chair, by just pointing out that one of the commentators that we received an input from was Tarin van der Walt, who in my opinion wrote a very good article on 49 before the commencement even, and I specifically asked her to comment on this bill, and she heard. We made the revised bill after these changes were made. We made that available to her. I've made it available to David Bruce of the ICE, of the CSVR, and I think he's now with the Open Society Foundation. Also to the ISS, Dr. Berger was the person we liaised with there, and also to Pierre de Force and Mervyn Bennen. Was they made a submission, but they didn't respond to the revised version. But Tarin, and I just want to say to mention what she said, I support the revised bill with regard to 49.2, mainly because the wording thereof has already passed constitutional muster. That, coupled with the Constitutional Court's approach in Makwanyane and another in 95, which was quoted and reiterated by Krichler in the Walters decision, does not leave much leeway anyway with regard to the use of deadly force during arrest. The bill and the Walters decision provides for the justifiable limitation of the suspect's constitutional rights in an open democratic society, while at the same time protecting the rights of law-abiding citizens and the arrestor. Chair, that's see. And I think the way forward is just that those empty seats
must be
filled. And
I see.
Things must happen.
I was a little disturbed when I saw that. I mean, I can't see that as being the way forward. Or does it mean as long as we're not sitting there, we're doing some work? JJ, followed by Dr. Ambrosini.
Chair, this was the sort of input from the department. We've got to advertise for public comment, and then we've got to engage with Phil. So I don't think we should have an extensive discussion now on the merits of the amendment. But I just think as far as the process point, input from the police would be useful. I mean, I know this bill is from Cabinet, so it's from effectively both, although it's been introduced by Justice. And then maybe just to not to engage in a debate on them, but the one thing I'm a little bit uncomfortable with, I mean, look, you've got, presumably in the Police Act, there's provisions for the use of force in conducting other police duties, particularly in dealing with demonstrations and stuff like that. It would be useful to see what those are. Those belong in the Police Act, not in the Criminal Procedure Act, because the Criminal Procedure Act is about bringing to court. I don't know whether there are any police guidelines for the existing Section 49. It would be useful to see those. The one aspect with the amendment I'm a bit uncomfortable with is the definition of deadly force. And what I'm uncomfortable with is that I haven't read, Walters, but I think from skimming it does refer, as I think Mr. DeLange said, to firearms. The definition now, the amended definition, includes, but it's not limited to shooting at a person with a firearm. And my worry is that there's a problem of people getting quite badly beaten up or even killed during an arrest. Not shot, beaten up. And Mr. DeLange's examples of karate chopping a geriatric and then setting a dog on a child, I don't think are particularly relevant ones, because the geriatric and the child are unlikely to be offering threats of serious violence to anyone, or having, maybe they could have, yeah. I mean, you do want to allow for the use of a karate chop or a blow with a baton in order to subdue the person. But you don't want to allow the space for repeated blows. I mean, we all know with the use of a firearm, it's usually one shot fired. I don't think the cases are around many shots in the body of the person. I'm just worried that the way that deadly force is worded at the moment could provide the space for an arresting officer to deliver a number of blows and then claim, okay, this was... I mean, a blow shouldn't be deadly force. So I think that I would have... I don't know if, what I'm raising is that... but I think that the main thing one's dealing with is firearms, so that should be covered. Then I think the category of other force should be only, you know, where necessary to affect the arrest and subdue. But we've just got to be careful my worry with the version, the definition of deadly force at the moment, is that it could be seen by police as allowing them to deliver a number of blows, and probably one blow is only necessary.
All right. I've actually given you some leeway because started by saying...
Okay, well, I'm just saying, no, look, it's not, it's just more raising it. I'm not expecting a debate or a response on it. I'm
well, the problem is
once I've raised it, people...
Yeah.
Okay.
So, honourable members, can we please restrict our comments as far as possible?
I can withdraw and just say let's get the...
serious.
Huh?
We'll be there. We'll be there. Calm down. Calm down. We need to do... I'm going to hear a few comments from you, and then I'm going to put to you the decision to call for written submissions, and then look at the way forward, which is not an empty National Assembly chamber, but including input from the police, how that's affected, and so on. Dr. Ambrosini and then Steve Swart.
It will be fast and short. Yes, I think we should have a public hearing and submission vote. First of all, a couple of issues, comments or questions for clarity. Clarity. This amendment, and I'm making some statement. If I'm incorrect, the presenters can correct me. This amendment is not required to address an issue of unconstitutionality. Walters was in a pre-existing version, and Walter is not on what we have on the books now. Looking at what has been done in this amendment, so first aspect of clarity. Second aspect of clarity, there has been, during the presentations, some confusion which reflected in John's own remark about the issue of self-defense. Here we are dealing with the shooting, with the killing of an innocent person in the absence of any reason of self-defense. If wherever there is a reason of self-defense, protecting from a threat of violence to the policeman, to the arrestor, we are beyond these parameters. So this is the suspect enjoyed the constitutional presumption of innocence. Given that parameter, I look back at this. This is not numbered, but at this slide, which is legal positions set out by the Constitutional Court. It is very clear that there are two aspects in the Constitutional Court parameters, G and H. G says, don't shoot, and I'm paraphrasing, unless there is proportionality. Force against force. That's the criterion in all the legal systems since the time of Cesar Beccaria in 1710. And that's the rule restated at the Constitutional Court. Then it gives us an exception under H, which describes with very limited circumstances only. So what they've done in this amendment, they've taken the exception and they've made it the rule. And I want to make sure that I understand it correctly. So G is no longer there. Shooting a suspect solely in order to carry out an arrest is unpermissible unless there are very limited circumstances. And what we have here, if I understand it correctly, because what is the change from the old to the new? It's not necessarily a change of clarity only. If I understand it correctly, the change from the old to the new is that it is possible to kill someone if the someone is on reasonable grounds suspected of having committed a crime involved violence before, not violence directed to the arrestor, but before, and is getting away with it. So the deadly force is for the purpose of securing an arrest. And I would like to ask, because these are split decisions, split moment decisions, and since the purpose is achieving clarity, what parameters are going to be given to the policeman by the law and by the training to determine whether the suspect can be arrested at that time or later. I mean, that's a constitutional criteria which needs to be expanded. It's not just possible to stick it in the law. How do you know whether you can arrest somebody later when he's running away? I mean, everyone can be arrested later. And that's the first. The second aspect of my concern, if I relate to what has been given to us, amendment requested by the Minister of Police and what is put in this slide. There is a great deal of confusion, which I wish went away, between the threat of violence to the arrestor and what we're talking about here. If somebody is posing a risk to anyone else, we are not in this environment. If it is a matter of shooting someone because it's threatening the arrestor, a third party, this provision does not come into force. So these are my initial comments and concerns, on which, just to ensure that my my reading is correct, on which perhaps I can have a reply from the department.
Steve Swan.
Chair, I want to understand the point that was made by my colleague Mario, the case of the threatened. I can understand a crime involving the infliction of serious bodily crime and the threatened infliction, because that's obviously the crux of the whole issue. And I remember our debates post-99 when we started to engage in this, and there was a lot of controversy, and this clause now has become known, if I understand correctly, as the shoot-to-kill clause. That has caused a lot of media controversy, and we will get into what the exact implications are of that. Clearly, the issue of self-defense and in defense of another person's life is very clear. We know the high crime rates in South Africa. But just obviously, our concern will look to the abuse of this power, the issue of police training that JJ referred to, policies, we need to look at that, and that's why it's good to have the Police Portfolio Committee here. At the end of the day, it's the balancing these perceptions and what is correct. But just to zone in on this issue of the test that has to be taken in that split second. The arrester suspects on reasonable grounds that the suspect has committed a crime involving the infliction of serious bodily harm. So is that, maybe Johan can comment on this, is that your assault GBH? Because assault GBH is not a life-threatening, it's not a murder, it's not a rape. Or the threatened infliction, if someone says, I'm going to beat you to death, and policeman overhears that, does that then mean, according to this test, it would appear that that person can then be shot? It's a threatened infliction of serious bodily harm. So we need to look very carefully at the implications of this, granted the fact that we've got high crime rate, the police are, we saw the two policemen in Kraaifontein with the shot dead, but at the same time, the possibility of abuse of the power, like we saw in the Takani matter, and that's obviously sub judice, we mustn't go into that, but that we all saw on television, the blow by blow by blow that JJ referred to as a concern. Thank you, Chair.
Just one brief question. Why do we need to refer to deadly force at all if we have a proportionality requirement? Surely it's implied in the proportionality test that if deadly force is necessary, then it will be necessary. Why do we need to specify? There is. If you say whatever force is necessary, and if in the circumstances deadly force is necessary, then why does it have to be specified?
Fortunately, Dr. Ambrosini is advocate the longer that must answer.
Thanks very much, Chair. I'm not certain at all. In fact, I'm fairly sure that I will not be able to satisfactorily answer at this point in time to all the questions raised. But let me try to respond to some of these issues. Firstly, with regard to the example that I used about children, deadly force, I think there may be a misunderstanding. Our concern was, if you say shooting is allowed, immediately there could be an argument that you're opening the door to apply violence and force and say, but I didn't shoot it, and therefore I'm not required to move within the parameters of the proviso. So what we try to do is really to widen the scope of when can you actually use brutal, very brutal force that may inflict serious injuries. But I don't think you need, as you remark, Chair, that we do not need to dwell upon that at this stage too much. There's going to be a lot of thoughts on that still. Then, staying with deadly force, what Ms. Schaffer, yes, the argument that she raises was raised by the Cape Bench, the Eastern Cape Bench. They came exactly with that argument. They said, why do you at all need the proviso? And that is true, and surely this committee will consider that. It is a valid argument. In our view, in my view, more subjectively, the part preceding the proviso is really enough to cover what we need. We want to have a proportionality test where you say, If you have to use violence, it must in all cases be proportional in the circumstances. But then we will have that conflict again, that we've got the Constitutional Court judgment that spells it out, that says you must be proportional. And then it goes further and says, you're not allowed to shoot, but if you shoot, then this and this must be. Now, if we omit that now, what message, how is it going to be interpreted? How are you going to train the police? How are you going to train everybody who needs to know what the criminal procedure says about this? I think the bottom line is, to put it very simply, I do not think it is practicable to allow or to leave it to people to read court cases if they want to know what the law says. In other words, if we do not repeat the criteria laid down by the Constitutional Court, the accessibility, that law will only be accessible to those who have the means or the in the position to go and access Constitutional Court libraries and read actual court cases. And to my best of my knowledge, I think that very rarely happens outside the academic scope. Yes, Dr. Ambrosini, this bill is definitely, in our view, it's not required to address any issue of constitutionality. Up to date, I've not found a single case on 49, as it is now, where constitutionality has been attacked. What has been attacked has not been in the courts, it's been academic circles, and then, of course, the police saying they find it very difficult to explain it to the people whom they must train. The only case about 49 that I've found so far did not involve this proviso at all. It's about a person, in fact, who did not even have the capacity to arrest, so it's really not relevant. So constitutionality, no, not required. Well, this presumption of innocence, you also referred to that. I'm sure that the arguments would be developed in the course of deliberations on that. All I want to say at this stage is that it has been laid down by the Constitutional Court. It is them that said, to make it absolutely clear, ordinarily such shooting, paragraph 8, I'm not going to quote it again. And I don't think it would be fair from me to now go and try and interpret the threatened infliction, for example. I think that if this committee is not comfortable with that at the end of the day, in the course of your deliberations, you will flesh that out. I agree that if it raises concerns, then it's something to be looked at. But I would exactly be trying to give you a false sense of security by trying to explain to you why you should accept it just like it is, which I'm not about to do. I think that covers basically everything, Jim.
All right, honourable members, for now, that's as far as we'll take this. I just need, before you go, Honourable Smuts, decision to call for written submissions. Are we all agreed? Thank you. Thank you. Sorry? Well, public hearings, when we receive the submissions.
Yeah, Chair, usually what we do is, I think it's an advert saying submissions, and then we reserve
the
right, because
yes,
we do end up with, unfortunately, a number of NGOs who come, I think, with the main purpose of promoting themselves and not actually contributing to our...
to the debate.
You know. Yeah.
All right. At this point, I mean, I can't see us not having public hearings. But as Mr. Jeffrey points out, it really depends, hinges on the submissions we receive. And then we'll take the decision. Thank you very much. The bulk of the committee members must go to another committee.